Welcome to Disrespect, exploring the stigma around disability, providing information and interviews to entertain and challenge listeners who care about, or care for, or may themselves have become someone with a disability. The response of the Ontario Court of Appeal to the Ontario government's attempt to deny autism funding to parents of children over 6 years of age has been a setback to the victory they won more than a year ago. In that light, there's not a lot to discuss about a government that promised in opposition to preserve this funding and in power has gone to court to deny it. Disrespect, however, revisits an earlier interview on the nature of autism and how disability, particularly autism, isolates the people affected by it. With us is the president of the Autism Society.
Welcome, Teresa.
Thank you.
To Disrespect, Teresa is not only the parent of a child with autism, but the president of the Autism Society. She's come with us today to Disrespect to talk to us about marginalization and disability. Teresa, lay the groundwork for us a little bit and tell us how you look at autism as someone knowledgeable about this subject, trying to communicate it to an audience that doesn't understand it very well.
Well, autism is a complex developmental disability. It appears typically during the first 3 years of life. It is a neurological disorder that affects, or it's better to say it's caused by a neurological disorder that affects the functioning of the brain. In the areas of social interaction and communication skills. So people who have it typically have difficulty in verbal and nonverbal communication, social interaction, leisure activities, play activities. They have a hard time communicating with others, relating to the outside world. In some cases, there may be aggressive and or self-injurious behavior. It can also cause repetitive body movements, unusual responses to people, and resistance to changes in routine, attraction to objects. And some individuals experience what is called sensory disintegration, which is basically a simpler way of saying that is sensitivities in sight, hearing, taste, touch, smell.
All right. And you've stressed that this is not a mental or conduct or a behavioral disorder, that there's no element of choice involved in any
Most
of this.
Certainly not, and that's something that we often have a challenge communicating to people, but it the difficulties that autism individuals have are rooted in a neurological disorder, yes.
Despite this, there are obstacles to identity with something as self-evident as autism. I mean, it's not hard to see that somebody with autism is facing challenges because the challenges are social or evident in everything that they do that involves other people. You talked about that with us, and you talked about that with children that you work with, that you're aware, especially teenagers, for whom identity issues we all know are important.
Yes.
You also stressed that there are links to other kinds of marginalization, poverty, racism, gender, class, and you raised the question of multi-marginalization. This is an interesting term. I hadn't heard it before. I think it will be useful for our listeners. Was it something that you coined?
Yes. In fact, I coined it while I was talking to you. But the experience out of which it comes is something that I'm very familiar with. My mother is African Nova Scotian. My dad had Native heritage. My dad was from the Mi'kmaq tribe. And both sides of my family were very poor. We grew up, my brothers and I, hearing stories, graphic tales of racism that my parents had experienced in their community on the south shore of Nova Scotia. And we were always aware that our experience, our own experience, was impacted on upon by racism.
As you experienced what you call multi-marginalization yourself.
Yes, certainly. So that's where it began. And as I grew up, I was always interested in issues that were related to racism. And then later on, I had an opportunity to become involved in the women's movement, in the shelter movement, and worked on behalf of women who were abused. I'm a very political person, a very community person. I tend to look at myself in relationship to a whole community rather than just in terms of my nuclear family.
Well,
so issues related to community and marginalization have always been important to me.
And through your involvement in these organizations, you explained to me before the interview that you this was how you made the connections between all these movements, that all of these people are marginalized, that the mechanisms by which they're all marginalized are similar, and that this affects people with disabilities as profoundly or more profoundly than it affects these other groups as well.
Most certainly. In my work in the Autism Society, I don't go through a week when I'm working with a family that I don't also have to deal with issues around poverty, cultural difference, racial differences, gender issues. People with disabilities and their families don't experience isolation in isolation. There are various forms of marginalization. They all come together often at the same time and affect the experience of the disabled person and his family.
I don't know how deeply you want to go into this yourself, but you spoke of different circles of intimacy of relationships, and that I'll let you explain it as deeply as you want to. The people with disabilities have a different relationship to the people around them than able people do, and that this
Sure.
is isolating.
Sure. I recently met a woman named Judith Snow, who is a disabled person herself, but she has written a book, which I've experienced as a book of wisdom, in which she basically talks about four concentric circles of relationship. There's the relationship of intimacy, and those are the relationships that we have with our immediate family, people with whom we couldn't imagine our lives going on without. Then we have the second circle of relationship, which is your circle of friends. Most of us have two or three of those. Then we have a circle of participation, which is environments like your work environment, your faith community, volunteer community. It could be your baseball team, your football team, whatever, people you meet in that circle of participation.
And this is the largest for most people
normally. For most people, it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a fourth circle, and that's the circle of exchange. And those are the people who are paid to be in your life, like your doctor, your lawyer. And in the typical person's life, that circle of exchange is quite small. But in a disabled person's life, that is usually the largest circle. The professionals that are involved in that disabled person's life usually take up the largest space in the four concentric circles.
And as you explained to me, people with disabilities have a disproportionately small circle
of
friends.
And circles of participation.
Participation, right.
And
so this makes this circle of paid contacts, it makes it proportionally much larger in their lives.
It does. And we get so much of our self-esteem, our feeling of being involved in a society, in a community, from our circle of friends and our
mm-hmm.
circle of participation.
Mm-hmm.
And in a disabled person's life, those two circles are virtually empty.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge to create for a disabled person a circle, those other two circles, the second and third circle, is one that we face all the time. But it's very important in helping that person to feel dignity and quality of life.
And now for a short break from our interview.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the president of the Autism Society discuss autism and alienation.
You also dealt with it. You thought that this circle of exchange, this circle of people who are paid to be with the person who's disabled, is very demanding, that they expect you to be available to them, that they're, if you want their participation, you really have to structure your life around a lot more contact with them than an able person would, and this itself is excluding and isolating.
Yes, it is. And right. and while you're arranging your life around the work lives of these individuals, whom I don't mean to suggest that they don't mean well, they certainly do, but the way we have taught ourselves to be in relationship to them is that we must be available to them and not the other way around. So a disabled person who requires a lot of services and involvement from professionals will have to arrange his or her life around being available to those people. And all the while that he or she is doing this, she knows that regardless of the quality of the care they're receiving, those individuals are there because they're contracted to be there. And if they were not contracted to be there, they wouldn't be there either. And that really affects the self-esteem of just try to imagine what it would be like if the only people in your life outside of your immediate family were people you knew were there because they were paid to be there and not because they were interested in you.
Yeah, and paid whether or not it's you they're seeing or somebody else.
Yes.
Sometimes that's yes. reflected in the nature of the care. Now, you mentioned that it's isolating for the family, too. I don't know that that's so obvious. Can you put that in context for us?
Well, in the context of an autism family, it's difficult for autism families to find, for example, respite care. The management of an autism individual's life requires a lot of time and energy from the parents. And when the parents do want to go out of the home, say, for example, for something as simple as dinner or any kind of entertainment, they have to find someone who will look after their family member. Mm-hmm. And that person cannot just be anyone. It has to be someone who understands autism and how to work with someone who has autism. And it's very difficult to find those people.
So this is isolating for them,
yes,
when
so
they have to be home,
sure,
with their isolated child.
Sure.
Or
so,
dependent, whether it's an adult child or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah. Supports are often secret or non-existent, too. One reason that they're isolating is there's not enough of them and they're not appropriate. You mentioned respite care. You mentioned alternative care. Now, it happens as we do this that there is a strike with special assistance?
Educational assistance in the public school system. And yes, that would immediately throw the lives of families who have their children in school into confusion, because now they have to find other care for their children so they can go to work, or maybe so that they can continue to do whatever it is they're normally doing during their day. And that is very challenging. I've had a lot of phone calls from families asking.
That's 24/7.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, it certainly is.
Now, we're not just talking about parents in the abstract or children in the abstract. We're also talking about you simultaneously as a parent of a child with autism as well. And you've told me that even if you weren't an autistic, the parent of an autistic child, you would have been an activist. You've come to these realizations and you've become an advocate for people with autism through your exposure and your perceptions about all these things. But you've also explained to me that this is not the most important thing in your advocacy, is the approval or consensus of the people who brought you to the formal position that you now hold. You really have to look at your activism through another lens. I'm sure this is true for the most committed of parents of autistic children. Tell us more about that.
Well, I certainly don't have any problem getting appreciation from people. I have my peers who advocate with me are very generous in their praise. I've had parents tell me that upon meeting me and upon meeting other advocates who are parents, that is, their relationship with us or their encounter with us has brought dignity and quality back into the lives of their individual family member and to their whole families as well. And that's very encouraging to me. But at the end of the day, the lens that I use to evaluate whether or not I'm doing a good job is the perspective of my own son. If I go home to him and I say, okay, are you happy? And I sometimes do that just to take his temperature. If he says yes, then I know I'm doing a good job. If he says no, and sometimes he does, I try to talk through those issues with him and help him to understand what it is I'm trying to do and try to understand from him what I need to do better to help him get to that point where he feels that he has dignity and quality of life.
You've explained to me how the system really is not your biggest help achieving this kind of empowerment for a parent of a child with autism to generalize that, in fact, the system requires that you present your child's shortcomings to qualify for supports. And you were very eloquent with that. Tell the listeners.
Well, what we seek to do as parent advocates is basically what we seek to do as parents, and that's present our children in their best possible light. We want to present them according to their strengths. That's what every parent wants to do. When you want to sit down and talk about your child, you want to be able to tell people the things about him or about her that really present him or her in a positive way. Yet the system for acquiring services necessitates that you emphasize deficits. You have to be able to present your child as almost a disaster in order to get the services you need to help him to be empowered. And it's a kind of catch-22 where I feel like, and I think what I told you in a previous conversation is that you end up, even though your goal is to empower the child, you spend all of your time trashing him on paper. Mm-hmm. And you can no more trash your way to empowerment than you can, if you'll forgive me for saying so, fornicate your way to virginity. It just doesn't work.
Right. But the system requires it.
But the system demands that you do that, and it's really frustrating to parents. It's difficult for a parent at the end of the day to feel that he or she is achieving the goal of empowering the child when she's had to present the child in that way.
Where does this leave you in terms of integration into an environment with able people and a measure of dignity and quality of life for you and the child? For instance, you explained it at school. Your school has gone to the great trouble of setting aside a learning resource room, but that in the eyes of some of his peers, it's become something different. Is this a product of the system? And tell us what happened and how you dealt with it, you know, as the authority in charge of seeing that your child is empowered and not trashed by the supports that he gets.
Okay. Well, this is the what I'm talking about is the learning resource room that you'll find in a school. And this is not just in my son's school. You know, there are learning resource rooms in schools all over.
Is this a necessarily separate space, or is it the nature of the system that makes this a separate space?
It's the nature of the system, I think, that makes it a separate space. But I want to emphasize that this space doesn't just exist in one school, it's in all of schools. And if you ask young people, the purpose of the space is to provide support to a child who needs extra attention or has special needs. But often, if you ask the young people in the hallways how they perceive this space, they'll tell you they perceive it as an exclusive area.
Mm-hmm.
So I've even heard some young people refer to it as the retard room,
right.
and that really affects the ability of anyone to access the Learning Resource Center with any feeling of self-esteem.
Again, to return to the lens of your son's perception again.
Sure, again, because that's what we must always do to analyze effectively whether or not we're achieving our goal. We want to create an inclusive space, but here we have this space that everyone perceives as exclusive. Well, what do we do about it? Obviously, we have to do something about this because they're not feeling it as inclusive, even though that's what we intend to. Our goal is to use it to help them be included, but they're not feeling it that way. So that tells us that it's not working and we have to go about it another way.
And we've just touched in this interview on how so much falls to the family, so much falls to volunteer organizations, so much of your advocacy is unfunded in a system which requires emphasizing of deficits. More and more is falling to outside organizations that are not well-funded. It seems a lot of responsibilities fall to you. Nevertheless, this doesn't have to be in itself a deficit?
No, it doesn't have to be. There are a number of families I know of in Hamilton who would be very excited at the opportunity of being able to design their own solutions to the challenge of how to create an inclusive space for their individual family member, how to help that family member create a life that is meaningful. And again, I use the terms dignity and quality of life because that's what the Autism Society is about, and that's what every parent who advocates for their child wants to create dignity and quality of life for their children. There are a number of parents in this community who would accept that challenge willingly, and they're the proponents of individualized funding. And it's a particularly creative group of parents who have visions for how they see their individual family member being involved in the community and ways and means to achieve that, but they need funding.
And this is a way to deal with multi-marginalization. This is a way to take the identity of each person with a disability from where the identity emerged, from their family, and take it out into the community instead of chopping it up in the community and trying to reassemble it at home,
Precisely. As
the system does now. Well, we appreciate you coming here today to give us a lead into what the problem is and what one of the solutions offered for it, maybe the most exciting solution offered for it is.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thanks, Teresa.
Okay, thank you.
You've been listening to the president of the Autism Society discuss autism and alienation. In the middle of the show, Pete Johnson and Death Ray Boogie. To round the show out, Pete Johnson again with Joe Turner. Roll 'em, Pete. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. To find out what we plan for the show, go to www.calendric.com/disrespect. That's C-A-L-E-N-D-R-I-C. www.calendric.com/disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.